Good. I think we can start. So, after having discussed the relationship between positivistic and natural law theory, the ethics of adjudication, and the limits of legal interpretation, we are now going to discuss a paper dealing with norms and normativity, or rather, as suggested by the title, with the unbearable heaviness of normativity. Nicola Muffato has been a member of the Girona legal philosophy community since September 2009. Before coming to Girona, Nicola studied law at the University of Trieste in Italy, where he graduated in 2005. Between 2006 and 2009, he completed a PhD in legal philosophy at the University of Milan, and his publications include a book on the semantics of norms and a more recent book entitled Norme e discorsi su norme. So before you begin your talk, I should ask you to limit your presentation at 45 minutes in order to allow us to have the time to discuss your paper. Thanks.
Thank you very much. I'm grateful to Andrea, to Giovanni Battista, and to Jordi for having invited me to speak here. And indeed, there are a lot of reasons to be brief. First of all, is that I don't want to cause sufferance to my audience with my terrible English. And this, I don't know, maybe in the formulation of Professor Finis applies to my case. Is my bad English a case of English? Is and second, I don't want to be boring and heavy as some author conceive norms to be, and also because it's difficult to speak after some important professors are Professor Finis, Professor Endicott, and a brilliant scholar as Paul Brady. So I will limit myself to a brief presentation of some topics. Indeed, it's also a work in progress, so I will be very grateful for your comments in the discussion. I try to present the main themes of my exposition as if I was were telling a story. But before telling the story, I'd like to sketch some, to present some classical distinction in analytical philosophy. And this distinction, as you can see from the abstract and from the endowed, are relative to the intention extension opposition concerning two dimensions of meaning, the separation, the trichotomy between token types and occurrences, and then another separation which traces a dividing line between ideal entities and concepts. I think that abstractions are kind of concepts. So to begin with the extension intention distinction. As you can see, I proposed a classical scheme which identifies the extension of a concept as a collection of individuals that follows under the concept, while the intention of the concept is the property or the properties ascribed to the individuals falling under that concept. This is the classical distinction. Of course, we can ascribe intentionality and extensionality not only to sentences, but also to predicates and to singular terms and to sets. So we have much oppositions. that is, we can describe sets as collection or as classes. We can describe singular terms as individuals or as individual concepts. We can describe predicates as collection of individuals or ordered entuples. Or we can describe predicates as properties or N-ary relations. Last but not least, we can describe sentences, the dimensions of the meaning of sentences, as extensionally as truth values or as propositions. But I will come back on this theme. The second distinction I'd like to draw is that between concept, abstraction, and ideal entities. Let's start from the notion of ideal entity. I believe this notion is an ontological one. Ideal entities are traditionally conceived as atemporal, uncreated, and unchangeable, independently existing objects. But real in a strong sense, in the sense that are real objects like a bottle of water, for example. I said that ideal entities are real, but the concepts of time and space usually do not apply to ideal entities. I think, as an example, to Platonism as a conception of ideal entities. Well, while realism and idealism affirm the existence of ideal entities, nominalism denies. It's a conception that denies the existence of ideal entities. Probably the most famous defender of nominalism is Guglielmo d'Occam, William of Ockham, who propose his famous Occam razors, that is, entia non sum multiplicanda praeter necessitatem, which has also a semiotic version proposed by Paul Grice that says that senses are not to be multiplied beyond necessity. I will turn later on this topic. On the other hand, we have concepts. Concept, I think, it's not an ontological, but an epistemological or semiotic notion. The two aspects are, in my opinion, interrelated. Concepts are not entities, nor a fortiori discrete entities. We can probably conceive them as processes implicit in what we perceive, in what we do, in what we think, and more important, in what we linguistically express. An important feature of concept talk is that existent talk doesn't properly apply to concept, because existence is not a property. So it's not a semiotic property, nor epistemological property. While ideal entities are eternal and atemporal, we can say that time and space attribution do not properly apply to ideal entities. Concepts have a history. The very notions of time and of space probably apply to concepts, in particular that of time. Concepts have a history in the sense that they could be modified by our use. I put in my presentation an example from William Clancy, which is a researcher in cognitive science at the NASA, who says that, for example, the meaning of planet is changing As we are discovering remote spherical objects between the size of 10 times Jupiter and brown dwarf stars. The very idea, read the concept, of planet is changing. Must a planet revolve around a star? If a planet is a source of heat, like Jupiter, then how is it different from a star? Could a planet be much larger than any other planet in our solar system? Could stars develop into planets? These questions, says Clancy, involve causal stories and blended classification, changing meaning relative to each other. So we can say that there is a strong asymmetry between the classical conception of meaning entities and this history about concept. I think that abstraction can be conceived as a kind of concept, abstract concept. In general, we can say that abstraction are concepts regarding some specific features of individuals or collection of individuals. And these features are considered relevant, in some case even necessary, and isolated by taking away. Indeed, the very Latin word abstraere means exactly to take away from. It's a taking, an abstraction is a taking away of some circumstantial, accidental aspects of a phenomena, for example. And a relevant feature of abstraction is that they are fundamental in the construction of logical vocabulary. The third distinction I'd like to draw is a distinction between type, tokens, and occurrences. This maybe is the more problematic of this tentative distinction, because it involves some problems in the exegesis of pairs, and I think that we cannot separate roughly these concepts from the whole context of pairs discussion, but probably we can try to, with a forced operation, to use this concept outside this context. Well, types can be seen as abstract standards, that is to say, as rules. As rules to which individual instances have to conform. As the same pair says, types do not exist. A type does not exist. It only determines things that do exist. This seem to agree with our concept of abstraction that I presented before. On the other hand, tokens, which in the semiotic vocabulary of pairs are also presented as actisign or sin signs, are concrete particular instances, facts, entities, objects, or events, with a unique spatio-temporal dimension, space-temporal dimension, or location. A token consists in the application or fulfillment of a standard, of a rule, of a type. To be a token, normally, an instance must reproduce a type, but this is another problematic issue. Let's now distinguish occurrences from tokens. Occurrences are abstract instances of complex types, which can be seen as expressions, plans, or as sequences. In fact, the very need to distinguish tokens and occurrences can be appreciated whenever we consider a complex type, including other simpler times occurring in it. For example, the type of the flag Old Glory includes 50 occurrences of the type of a five-pointed star. Note, however, that an abstract complex time may be a sequence of concrete individuals, as, for example, when I say that in the sequence of New Jersey $1 million lottery winners, the same individual, the same concrete person, occurs twice. It's a quite strange case. So with this raw instruments, let's try to investigate something about normativity. As I promised, now I tell you the story of let's say, ontological distinction presented by Altshuler and Bulygin. Altshuler and Bulygin started to study this problem because they have logical troubles concerning the application of logic to norms. So they try to formalize in different ways this, in logical vocabulary, this problem, and they ended considering that this logical problem has probably an ontological and semiotical basis. So they distinguish two conceptions of norms. Probably presenting these two conceptions as mutually exclusive and jointly exhaustive. This is probably one can argue this conclusion interpreting two free texts. The main text is the expression of the conception of norms, but there are also some observation in Pragmatic Foundation for a Logic of Norms, and in another paper, if I'm correct, on Weinberger and Kelsen, Ontology of Norms. So we can try to reconstruct their ideas basing on these three texts. These two conceptions of norms are called by Altshuler and Bulygin hyletic conception, hyletic conception, and expressive conception. I don't know the reasons that moved Altshuler and Bulygin in the choice of the term hyletic. I have some perplexity because the term hyle in Greek language means matter rather than ideal. Then it's a term which is opposed, for example, in Husserl vocabulary to morphe. Ile is the raw matter to which the intentional activities of the subject project. So I don't know. Probably another term would help us to make much more clear this distinction. But anyway, according to the hyletic conception, norms are proposition-like entities. Proposition-like entities, which, according to Altshuler and Bulygin, are abstract and can be conceived as purely conceptual. Anyway, as the author said, an hyletic norm is independent from language. Hyletic norms have an independent existence. This seems to me to conflate our earlier distinction between ideal entities and concepts. They seem to conflate these two characterizations. A norm is a prescriptive meaning entity, a proposition-like entity, said the authors, not susceptible of truth and falsity. This can lead us to suspect that the very label proposition-like entity is a metaphor. But if it is a metaphor, it's a quite misleading metaphor, because it has some important and dangerous bearings on other aspects of their theory. And I try to sketch briefly how this aspect in the following points. The expressive conception, instead, says that norms are the result of prescriptive speech acts, of a prescriptive use of language. This time, we are speaking of results, but I'm not sure that this result have to be conceived as objects. Indeed, we can probably say that this is another metaphor, that Alciuroni Buligin probably wanted to say that according to the expressive conception, the pragmatic dimension of analysis is more important than the semantic dimension of analysis. So if eclectic conception bears on the dimension of meaning, of focuses on the semantic dimensions, the expressive conception pays more attention to the pragmatic aspects of communication. Well, let's now take a look to some relations between the two conceptions. First of all, we have to try to solve this ambiguity between the possibility to conceive eclectic conception as eclectic norms as meaning entities or as meaning abstractions. And the same thing we can say about the expressive conception, because if the expressive conception relies on a distinction between the force of an expression and its meaning, probably we have to consider the aspect of meaning in the same way we divided the eclectic norms in two possibilities, in considering proposition and norm in the eclectic norms as abstraction or as ideal entities. So in this sense, we have to opt for nominalism or for Liarism. This is our choice we are called to make. These problems affecting the ontological sphere, the semantic, semiotic, pragmatic spheres, have important consequences when we have to formalize in a logical language the structure of a norm. Eclectic conception thinks that presents the logical structure of a norm by using the deontic modalization, the modalities of obligation, permission, prohibition, indifference applied to propositional contents. The classical form is OP, where O means obligatory and P means the propositional content. While the expressive conception applies not modal operators as the ontic model operators as obligation, permission, and the like, but indicators of the force of the expression. These are not functional operators. These operators do not make any contribution to the semantic content of the sentence, of a sentence, for example. So this generates a series of problems to concerning the possibility of build logical relations between norms and propositions. Let's take stock for a while. For the expressive conception, as I said, a norm, an expressive norm, is to be represented by an operator which is a force indicator, a pragmatic indicator. While, according to Alciuran and Bulygin reconstruction of expressive conception, the propositional part, which is often indicated with the letter P, is a full-fledged proposition. Now, are we to conceive this full-fledged proposition as a truth bearer or not? As a complete indicative sentential device which is apt to express a sentence, a complete sentence, or not? Or is a syntagmatic expression, an expression which explores and expresses only the dimension of reference? This is an important problem, because then we have to opt for one of these two alternatives. Now, Alciuran and Bulygin also said that while eletic conception presents eletic norm as operations on propositions, expressive conception presents expressive norms as a special use of proposition. So we have to distinguish an operation on proposition from a specific pragmatic use of proposition. I propose to interpret the term operation as a logical term, not as a pragmatic expression. Still, this point apart, we are faced with a problem which is, as I briefly said before, parallel to the problem faced by eleticists. That is to say, are we pragmatically using meaning entities or meaning abstractions when we are talking about proposition? Well, a nominalist defender of expressivism would probably urge that since normal language dependent, their propositional content cannot be an ideal meaning entity. But expressive norms are not simple propositions. They are results of a particular use of proposition. So, probably a realist might object, why couldn't we use in speech ideal meaning entities? Well, this problem is related to the question about how, if ever, norms start or stop existing according to expressive conception. Well, depending on what version of this conception we adopt, we can discriminate a series of solutions. For example, let's take eletic conception. According to eletic conception, norms are meaning entities. That is, if we take an idealist, realist sense, a temporal and dot created ideal entities. They do not start and nor stop existing. Although it seems that we can distinguish between merely possible and really existent norms, as Otto Weinberger does, from the point of view of the ideal entities, this alleged difference is quite implausible. So I think that Weinberger's reconstruction of eletic conception is at odds with a realist stance on meaning entities. On the other hand, expressive norms are the results depend on a special use of language, namely of a happy and successful prescriptive speech act performed at a certain time t and in a certain place s. Nonetheless, this very definition is open to two alternative interpretations. That is, one may conceive expressive norms in terms of ideal meaning entities, creation, that is, proposition creation, but this openly contradicts the above sketched notion of meaning entities as a temporal and created entities. Indeed, how can a fact, an institutional fact, make an ideal object exist? Ricardo Caracciolo rightly pointed out that this problem is due to an illegitimate substitution. A substitution due to the fact that the expressivist identifies the possibility of a norm with the possibility of an institutional fact, namely performing a prescriptive speech act. The other possible interpretation is the sequence. One may conceive the following. One may conceive expressive norms in terms of ideal meaning entities. Ideal meaning entities use, propositions use. This solution doesn't commit the expressivist to reject the possibility of some relation between norms and facts. Indeed, the expressivist could and may establish membership criteria referring to these very facts in order to form a set of propositions contingently used with prescriptive force. For example, we could say that a certain proposition P belongs to a certain system S in virtue of its having been used on certain occasion T and by the subject X to perform certain prescriptive speech act K. Note that this strategy doesn't amount to treat norm as facts. Expressivists merely use fact-referring criteria as constitutive of the intentional relation of membership. So the main trouble with this interpretation, with this conception, is that we have to explain how is it possible to use a non-empirical entity, an ideal entity? Then we have a third option, a third solution, that is to conceive expressive norms as institutional facts. But in this case, probably we wouldn't have to use the term result to refer to expressive norms. The intentional equation between norms and institutional facts allows the expressivist applying to norms time, space, causal, and probably also pedigree relation, but only at the cost of generating some kind of dilemma. Indeed, I think that is not a real dilemma, as I try to show later, but we can present it as a dilemma. But since an institutional fact is a brute fact qualified by a norm which sets specific correctness condition of subsumption, We can correctly apply the concept of norm only to those facts that meet the condition imposed by a norm. But this makes our definition of norm either circular, norm is a fact qualified by a norm, either open to infinite regress. Norm is a fact qualified by a second order norm. Why I think that this is not a genuine dilemma? Because I think that the term norm in the two sides of the equation doesn't maintain the same meaning. So these are the principal problems with this free interpretation. We have fourth and the fifth, if in the fifth possible interpretation of eletic and expressive norm. According to the fourth interpretation, eletic norms are meaning abstraction from concrete prescriptive speech X. While on the fifth interpretation, expressive norm are the results of a special use, of a prescriptive use, of meaning abstraction. Well, I think that option four calls for an interpretation of prescriptive use, while five option is clearly circular, because it relies on pragmatic criteria to distinguish norms from propositions. So let's leave for a second aside these troubles. And let's concentrate on the meaning of the term proposition. Is proposition to be conceived as a kind of meaning, a meaning entity, a meaning abstraction, or as an instance of a rule of meaning? If we say that the meaning of an expression is determined by norms, is rule governed, we have to distinguish between instances of this rule, rule following, and proposition or meanings as abstraction from concrete speech X. So we have to take a clear solution. We have to adopt a choice. We have to choose between two conceptions of meaning, of meaning entities, of proposition, and of eletic norms. We have to say either there are instances of rule following, that is, following rules of meaning, either they are meaning abstraction. This seems to, involve the distinction between type, tokens, and occurrences. In other words, we have to choose if meaning entities, meaning proposition considered as meaning entities, are to be considered as instances of a type or as types. Well, this is the last one of the main troubles I want to indicate regarding the eletic expressive distinction. There are many others, but I will limit myself to this that I mentioned. This is the destruens part. It's not very destruens, it's more at the construction of the eletic expressive dichotomy. And so now I will try to propose an alternative scheme, an alternative paradigm of analysis. Indeed, it seems that Alciura and Bouligin assume that the meaning of an expression is something different from its use. they seem to assume that the meaning of an expression consists in its truth conditions. But of course, there is another important stream in analytical philosophy of language that conceive the meaning as the inferential role that an expression or a substantial expression can play in an inferential reasoning, in articulated reasoning structure in inferential terms, articulated in inferential terms. This alternative paradigm of analysis involves the concepts of commitment and entitlement. Those familiar with Brandom making it explicitly will surely recognize the main topics to which I refer. So let's now try to develop an alternative paradigm. We can say that there are, in one sense, norms are prescriptive speech acts. That is, speech acts that are used to make the audience, the other part of the meaning of the communicative relation, do something. It is some sort of a relation of guidance. The subject which issues the prescription wants to guide the conduct, the behavior of the other part. This is a communicative relation which can probably be explained in conventional terms. That is, we can try to interpret the intentions of the speaker as a series of sneak intention. That is to say, the subject which who issues the prescription intended that the audience interpret his intention as a reason to do what he prescribed in virtue of this very reason. It's a virtuous circularity in Grice's explanation. And this is probably one plausible conception of norms, which relies on the concepts of intentions. But no, not only on the concepts of intention, because it invokes also the concept of commitment, in the sense that a meaning expression, a sentence, for example, has to be interpreted as a prescription, even if the issuer of the subject which who issues the prescription indeed doesn't actually have this very intention. We have to consider not the actual intention, but the internal intention, which is necessary to reconstruct the dynamic of the communication. This is one sort of reconstruction of the concept of norm. An alternative concept, which I called deontic judgment, recalling a distinction from Bayon and from Nino, is that conceives norms as assessments of correctness of actions. That is to say, these assessments need not to be conceived as speech acts, need not to be expressed as speech acts, but they are presupposed in the very concepts of speech acts. Last but not least is the concept of implicit norm, of commitment, which I referred before. An implicit norm is a norm implicit in the practice of issuing and ordering, of promising, in There are a lot of different kinds of commitments, epistemic, doxastic commitments. There are deontic commitments in the prescriptive speech act practice. But in general, we can say that these implicit norms regards concern the very possibility of conceive a practice. Here I'm referring in particular to the paradox of interpretations of Wittgenstein, which Professor Endicott explained above in surely better terms than I. If I have to follow a rule, I cannot use an interpretation of that rule as a criteria to establish what is and what is not a correct instance of following that rule, because this will generate a regress regarding the rule that governs the interpretation of the first rule. So I have to rely on implicit norm, or conceptual objective norms implicit in the practice that will guide my assessment of correctness. So these are three elements to reconstruct normative practice. These are three independent but interrelated elements, because prescriptive norms as prescriptive speech acts need to be based on the very concept of deontic judgment, which is an assessment of correctness of actions independent from the expression of the very expression of speech act, and from the idea of implicit norms. Implicit norms can be conceived in two different ways, and this is bifurcation, a dichotomy to explore. I don't claim to have a precise idea regarding this topic. I limit myself to present these two options. An implicit norm can be conceived as a constitutive rule in the Searle sense. That is to say, a rule that can be presented in the form X counts as epsilon in the count in the context C, or a regulative, or as a regulative rule. That is a rule that governs a pre-existing action, not constituted by that very rule. So we have these options. The most important thing is that these rules cannot be explicit rules, because if they were explicit rules, then we have the regress argument of the interpretation of the rules of Wittgenstein argument operating. So this is probably the most striking problem of this alternative conception. Opting for a conception of implicit norm as constitutive rules or as regulative rules. That is to say, interpret rules of meaning as prescription, as regulative rules, or as constitutive rules. I don't, I will not opt for one of the two horns of the dilemma now. And I hope to make clearer my thought in contesting to your question in the debate that I leave now open the space to the debate if you agree.
Thank you very much.